The gentleman who is our guest speaker, Dr. Paul O. of Laguna Beach, and I'm sure that you're going to enjoy this gentleman's message. So, Dr. Paul, if you will.
Hi, my name really is Paul, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
In fact, I wonder, I haven't seen the hands lately. Could we see the hands of all the alcoholics in the room? Would you raise your hand, please? God, you look good to me. I wonder if my wife, Maxine, is the only Al-Anon in the room. Could we see the hands of the Al-Anons, please? That's good. You look unusually well recovered this weekend. What about newcomers? It's a convention, but could we see the hands of the newcomers? Anybody with 30 days or less of sobriety on this program, would you raise your hand, please? If you have a drinking problem, I guess you found out you're in the right place. With all that you've heard over this weekend, and with my rambling, you may get tired as I try to give you this whole program and my pitch here, which I can't do anyway, and nobody can do. But if you get bored and stop listening, just remember the short version. If you just keep coming to meetings, and don't drink between meetings, things will start to getting better. I was amazed at the number of things that improved, the number of problems that went away when I simply stopped drinking, something I hadn't been able to do until I came here. I said that my name was Paul, and that wasn't true, particularly before I came here. My name then, before AA, was Paul H. Oliger, M.D., addressed as Dr. Oliger, and you better remember it. Anybody that called up and asked for Paul or Dr. Paul was considered a smart aleck trying to get past the receptionist, and they never made it. Today, that's the fastest way to get to me. I had to maintain my front at that time. I thought it was, I called it my professional elbow, but not let people get too close. I thought it was for their benefit. I'd like to pretend it was for their benefit that I didn't let people get too close. I got along reasonably well. Most of the years in practice, as long as I stayed on my side of the desk and you stayed on your side, when you got too intimate or wanted to know how I was, as distinct from telling me how you were, I became uncomfortable. And if you insisted on pursuing this or leaning over the desk too much or whatever, and I got uncomfortable, I could always say, let's go in the other room and you get undressed and I'll examine you. And I found it a lot easier to dominate somebody when they were naked and I wasn't. And that's the way that went. I was afraid of people. I said that I was a real alcoholic, and even that also wasn't true until I came here. I didn't come here as an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic until I came here. I was drunk an awful lot, but I wasn't an alcoholic. In fact, I was a drunken doctor. I was a falling down, paralytic, bedwetting drunk, and a working drunk. And I didn't like being a drunken doctor. I didn't like me. I didn't like what I was doing. I didn't like what I wasn't doing. I wasn't living up to my potential, I thought. I never came up to my expectations of me. And the people out there never came up to my expectations of them. And this bothered me enough that it kept me drinking. My wife kept me drunk for years. But I, as a drinking doctor, what I would do is I drank to get to sleep. If I ever had a reason to drink, it was in order to get to sleep at night. I had found out back in the early days of school that I could, that was in pharmacy school, and I could work in the drug, go to pharmacy school all day, then work in the drugstore all evening, and study into the part of the night, and then jump in bed and try to sleep real fast, and everything I'd studied would get all mixed up in my mind, and I wouldn't rest well, and I'd wake up both stupid and tired. But if I drank, I could sleep real good, and I'd wake up refreshed and smart. And I chose to be smart. And all the way through school, I always graduated with honors and that. So the drinking certainly didn't interfere with my schoolwork. When I was practicing, I would drink myself to sleep, and the longer I did that, the shorter the duration of the sleep would be. And I would have to drink myself back to sleep 2 and 3 times a night. But I never became a drinking doctor because of that. I had a 5 o'clock shutoff date, 5 a.m. If I awakened at 5 a.m., I would stay awake. If it was 1 minute to 5, I'd drink myself back to sleep. And then I had the flu an awful lot. Seemed that alcohol lowered my resistance. But I never took a morning drink. What I did in place of that was what I would do for any patient that felt tired and run down and couldn't get going in the morning. I gave myself Benzedrine. Except that with myself, I never could judge dosages. I would take a handful of anything. The first thing in the morning, I would take a handful of Benzedrine, and then during the day, I'd take more in order to feel better, or in order to keep on feeling good, or I don't know, just because it seemed like the thing to do. So I would take it during the day, but I didn't drink during the day. And boy, I did some wild things. A lot of times I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying. I can remember the feeling of saying, I'll step back and I think, my God, listen to me go. I wonder what I'll say next. You know? And I remember one time I was examining, when I examine patients, I stand this way and they're sitting facing this way, and the ladies have on this little plastic thing that they put their arms through that makes them feel like they have something on. And when I examine the head, eyes, ears, and the neck, and then I take this thing and drop it down, and they're sitting there topless. And then I put my right hand over the left breast to feel for lumps. And as I do that, I always say, do you examine your breasts regularly for lumps? And I never put my hands on a woman's breast without saying that. And this puts it on an ethical, professional basis or something. And and they get to thinking, well, I used to do that and I never found anything, so I quit, or I guess I should do that and I forgot, or whatever. But one day I was examining this woman who wasn't very well endowed in that department, and I don't know how, how thirsty he thinks I am or how long he expects me to talk. Could almost take a bath and then... Anyway, I put my right hand over her left nubbin and I looked her in the eye and I said, do you check your lumps regularly for breasts? This program has done a lot of things for me, but it hasn't improved my bedside manner any, because I think of that periodically when I'm examining somebody. But because I used the Benzedrine in order to counteract the effects of the booze, then it took more booze to put me to sleep, which is what I started drinking for in the first place. If I ever really had a reason for drinking, I don't really know why I drank. Seemed like the thing to do at the time, essentially. But because of the Benzedrine, then I had to take sleeping pills, and that to supplement the booze to get me to sleep, or at least it seemed like I ought to. And for a while, I was taking sodium pentothal. You know, that's the stuff that the oral surgeons use, and they squirt it in your vein, and they tell you to count to 10, and by the time you get to 2, you're asleep. Only I was doing it to myself, and I couldn't drive down to the office and give myself an injection and put me to sleep and still drive home and go to bed, and I couldn't lie in bed and give it to myself like I'd have liked to, and have one of my daughters yelling, "Hey, Ann, come and watch Daddy. He's going to give himself his nightly fix." So I would have to... I decided to keep it out in the garage, in the bag, in the car, and I'd find some reason for going out to the garage. And then I'd have to calculate the dose that would counteract the Benzedrine and add to the booze and be just enough that when I got it squirted in, I could take the needle out and the trinket off and throw it in the bag and close the bag and throw it in the car, close the garage door, run in the house and flop in bed before I went to sleep. And that got increasingly more difficult to do. I don't think with a computer I could have figured it out. It was very complicated. But life at that time was very complicated. Everything was complicated. I had the feeling that if I could just get you and it and her and him and myself to do everything just right, and if you all did the things just the way I wanted, everything would be all right, but you never did. And somehow you always blew it, and it was usually my wife. She and I had increasing amount of difficulty at that time. This is where we went through the stage where she used to say, you don't love me anymore, do you? You don't love me. Why don't you admit it? And then she'd later on say, you love me, but you don't like me. And ultimately she got to the point where she said, you hate me. Why don't you admit it? You hate me. And so I admitted it. And in fact, what I said to her at the time was that there was nobody in the world whose guts I hated. There was one person, only one person in the world whose guts I hated worse than hers, and that was my own. And that's the way I felt. I hated myself, and I hated her. I hated her for loving me, or saying she did when I didn't believe it. This is when I was so suicidal, and I'd been suicidal so long, so much of the time. I was so sick of contemplating suicide and thinking of ways to do it and trying different methods. I could only think of one thing that would make my life worse, and that would be to turn out to be labeled as an attempted suicide. So I didn't want to try it and fail. And at least that's the rationalization I used as to why I didn't succeed in it. I had a gun there, but I thought of the story of a person who had shot themselves in the head, and instead of killing themselves, all they did was remain an invalid for the rest of their life. And I didn't want that. And but that seemed like that wouldn't happen if somebody, like I'd heard, where you could put a shotgun in your mouth and pull the trigger with your toe, but that sounded too gory. And using gas seemed too slow. And like they say, sometimes you get bored and light a cigarette and blow that. And but I was tired of thinking of suicide. I had all my life insurance policies changed over to double indemnity. And then I got the idea that now that I had them changed over, I had to wait 2 years before I could collect on them, so I couldn't commit suicide in 2 years. And God, I was glad to think of that. Now I didn't have to listen to me think about suicide anymore. In fact, it's one of the things this program has really done for me. My imaginary conversations have improved tremendously. It's much more comfortable this way. The things I think about and talk about to myself, and the people I talk to in my imagination, are so much better than they were. But I hadn't come here as an alcoholic, as I said. I was sent here by stupid psychiatrist who couldn't see that my trouble was all due to a bad marriage, and was sent here from a psycho ward of the hospital. And it seemed that what had happened was that I had gone to the Mayo Clinic. I thought I had a brain tumor. I had gotten so befuddled and confused and headaches and personality change and all that I decided I must have had have a brain tumor, and I was sent to the Mayo Clinic by this doctor that couldn't figure out why I had convulsions. I had convulsions twice, and on both occasions I hadn't drunk the night before, so to me that was proof that I was not in that the alcohol had nothing to do with it. And, of course, I hadn't told him how I was drinking. And I went to the Mayo Clinic, and Max packed the bags, and I packed the booze, and we went off there. And at the clinic, it is just a clinic. You don't stay in the clinic. You stay in a hotel, a rinky-dink little hotel across the street, and you run back and forth through these underground chambers. And we spent 9 days with me taking all these tests, and I figured at the end of that time they were going to tell me that I had a brain tumor and that it was inoperable and that there wasn't anything they could do and that I was going to die, and I was glad. But at the end of that time, the doctor saw me, and instead of saying that, he said, "I think before you ought to do that, I think you ought to be seen by our psychiatrist." And I figured, well, that would be for clearance, and just before he operated, so there wouldn't be any problem with that. The next thing I knew, he decided I should go in for some observation, and then I decided I would do that, but I realized that that was a mistake. By the time I heard his steel door slam behind me, and I was locked in. There they kept giving me pills and things to sedate me and keep me from having convulsions, I think, in their nice clean ward. And they kept me so groggy from pills, but at the same time they kept telling me to come on out and be active in ward activities. Real fun things like making leather belts and that sort of thing. I remember one time it was right at Christmas time in 66, and they wanted me to come out and color Christmas cookies, all these various colors of cookies. It reminded me of back home with my sister used to do this, and It reminded me of that, and I had disliked my sister so much, and this didn't help any, remember all that. And I was so groggy and dopey, I don't know how she dragged me out of there to even get this knife in my hand to try to stab the icing to put it on these stupid cookies. And I tried that for a little while until I told her what she could do with her cookies. And in fact, I knew enough about hospitals to know how to get out of it, how to get out of there, so I signed out. And I had the trouble getting my wife to agree to take the responsibility for taking me out, but I yelled and screamed enough until she did. And the resident there in psychiatry had me sign my name to the thing, saying I was leaving against advice. And he said, "Well, I hope you make it, but I know you won't." And this angered me tremendously, to think that this squirt of a resident could tell me, a physician who was in practice and had already gotten my specialty training and knew what I was doing, he could tell me that I couldn't make it. But I think it helped. That was the beginning of a turning point when he said that. We got on a plane then to fly back to Ohio and back to California. We came through Ohio. But on the way, the first thing that happened was we had a big fight over whether or not I was going to drink the free drinks on the plane. It seemed like the thing to do. Everybody else was drinking them, and there were just a few drinks. You could only have, what is it, three. And but we had a big fight over that. And finally, but Max won. I didn't drink them, except that I sat and pouted all the way back. I wouldn't eat the meals either. And my kids knew that, I guess I was going to say they knew I was a nut, but I guess they'd known I was a nut for a long time. But anyway, the first thing I did when I got off the plane was to get a bottle of scotch and drink it all and go to bed. And the next day, my wife called the neurologist that had sent us there and told him what had happened. And he called the psychiatrist that he knew, and he arranged for us to go and see him. And he talked to me for about 45 minutes, and then he talked to Max for about 15 minutes, and then he talked to me for about 5 minutes, and he decided that I better go into the hospital. He decided that he also thought I should go into the hospital for observation, and that's why how I ended up in the psycho ward back near home. It seemed like he didn't pay much attention to me in there. And after about 3 days, I caught him on the way out when he's ready to leave. And I told him I was doing so fine now that I didn't see any reason why I needed to stay for the full week, like he had said. And I thought I could go home now. And he said, "I didn't say a week, I said 2 weeks." And I didn't remember it that way, but I thought, well, I must have misunderstood. So when it got to about 12 days, as I recall, I stopped him again, and I said, "Now I really feel good. I'm really getting along just great. Everything is wonderful, and I don't see any reason to stay here for the 2 weeks, and I think I should go home tomorrow. I got to get my office going, and I got things to do, and I should leave now." And he said, "I didn't say 2 weeks. I said 3 weeks." And I thought, well, that seemed kind of strange that I wouldn't remember that, and that we could play that game and I'd die of old age in that psycho ward. So I decided I'd have to find a new approach. And while I was thinking and trying to think of a new approach and not doing very well, one day he asked me if I'd like to talk to the man from AA, and I didn't know why. I didn't know what I could do for the man. But I still didn't realize that was my problem. I remember in a very short time, Frank was there, had a very loud voice, and kept talking about alcoholic and alcoholism, and he was an alcoholic and AA meeting. And I kept wondering why he didn't lower his voice, that all these crazy people there thought I was an neurotic, and why didn't we just leave it that way? I didn't want the other patients to think I was an alcoholic. But when he asked me if I'd like to go to a meeting, I said I wouldn't like it, but I'd go, because I knew he'd report me back to the psychiatrist if I didn't go. And so I went, and I don't know how many meetings I went to before I even realized where I was, what meetings I was going to, because my blackouts came and went, and even in this stage, my awareness came and went. I would have flashes of being in with it, and then times when it would be gone again. And even though I remember those conversations with Frank, I don't remember what meetings I'd gone to for a while. But eventually, I remember being at the meeting, and I remember the psychiatrist constantly asking me what meeting I'd been to, what went on, what it was like, what happened, and what I was going to next, and so on. And I was very curious as to why he wanted to know all these details about the meetings, and it appeared to me that I must have myself an alcoholic psychiatrist. And it even made me wonder how long I'd have to go to meetings before he'd get sober so I could go home. And, what I found out eventually was that in his residency training, he had taken, he had gone to AA meetings as part of his training to become a psychiatrist. And he's very interested in AA and has a particular interest in talking alcoholics into making the program. And I don't see him anymore, and didn't see him very long once I got to AA, because he doesn't feel that once a person gets to AA, he has anything more to offer them once they make it. Once they start to make it, that AA can take over and there's no need to see him too. But I came on the program then, and it started out with a simple thought that it was obvious that the psychiatrist thought that if he kept me coming to these meetings long enough, that when he turned me loose, I'd keep on coming. And so I thought I'd go along with that silly game, and that's exactly what happened. And I kept coming to the meetings, but for 6 months I didn't quite get the point of what the whole thing was about, really. The pills and all had disappeared pretty much, and the drinking had dropped down to the point where I wasn't getting into serious difficulties with it. But I would even go to meetings, and on the way home, I'd feel fine on the way to the meeting, enjoy the meeting, and feel good on the way back, and the car would stop at a liquor store. And then I would feel that the liquor store man would think I was very odd if I didn't walk in and buy some booze or something. Never occurred to me to buy cigarettes or something, but I had to go in and buy something. It was just as casual as that, that I would buy something to drink, take it home and drink it. And until 6 months after I'd been on the program, my daughter said to me, a young daughter one time, as I walked in, said, "What's the business of you all the time going to these AA meetings and always bringing home something to drink?" And that seemed like a logical question for which I had no good answer. And it seemed that about that time, the compulsion to drink left me. And I haven't had a drink since then. About that time, I got the feeling that you had given me the tools, shown me the way, and from now on, if I didn't get well, it was my own fault. And that I had a disease that was caused by alcohol. And staying on this diet that you recommended, an alcohol-free diet, that I wouldn't have any problems with alcohol. And I haven't been drunk since my last drink. It's as simple as that. It's about that time, too, that my wife started going to Al-Anon, and we go to each other's meetings. We go to meetings together a great deal. We have our friends other couples are on AA and Al-Anon, and we share meetings with them, and our social life revolves around AA. And AA is a way of life, definitely, with us. It takes care of everything we need up to this point. And I'm not a drunken doctor anymore. I think I practice a little better brand of medicine today. At least I'm more comfortable with it now. During the time when I came to AA, as I said, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And about 3 years before that, I did know that I had a drinking problem. And at that time, I had tried very diligently to quit drinking for over a number of years. And I tried so many different things, retreats and changing brands of booze and taking all the liquor out and giving it to a friend and telling him to keep it until I asked him for it. And I asked him for it when I found out or got the idea he was having parties with my booze and not inviting me. And then was at that time that I tried, we have a bar that has folding doors on it, and I put a lock on the bar and gave the key to my wife, of all people. And every night we'd have a fight over whether or not she was going to give me the key to get one drink. And it seems like I always won. I can remember when she'd go to get the key. I would listen very attentively to hear whether she'd opened a drawer or a cupboard or what, so that when she went to sleep, I'd know where to go to sneak around looking for that silly key. And sometimes I'd find it, and then she'd have a new place to hide it, and sometimes I didn't, and we'd start the game over again. In fact, then I'd go up to the liquor store and get some things to drink, and then try to get in the bar to get more, because I'd only bought a little bit, and it wasn't enough. I can remember seeing these Humphrey Bogart movies and others where they pick locks in penitentiaries and all the kinds of locks, and so I figured, well, this is just a little 10-cent store lock. I could pick that. And here I was, down on the floor with a hair bobby pin, trying to pick this stupid little lock. And I tried that again and again and again. And I never did succeed in getting that thing unlocked. And finally, what I would decide is, well, whose god darn bar is this anyway? And I'd rip it off, you know. So locking the bar hadn't helped any. I remember at that stage that I prayed a lot. I was a fantastic prayer. And I figured the best time to pray, to ask God a favor, was to right after receiving communion. And I'd go to communion every Sunday and sometimes every day. And then after communion, I would explain it to him about how humble I was and how omnipotent he was. And after I'd grovel quite a while and then flatter him quite a while, and then I'd tell him to go ahead and take care of this little problem of mine. And then I'd go home and wait. And while I was waiting, I'd mix me a little drink. And then I'd go back next Sunday and do it all over again. And I did it again and again and again. And I finally got the notion that he didn't hear me, that there's no use talking to him, that he wasn't listening to me. I suppose today I think that probably what was happening was that maybe he was listening and was even answering and saying, "Not yet, stupid," because 3 years later I did wake up in NAA with no positive action on my own part, without even wanting it. That's where I ended up. The fact that I had drunk at that time to the point of even getting acute pancreatitis, didn't seem to impress me too much. I didn't realize the extent of my drinking problem. One night I was rolling on the floor with severe abdominal pain and temperature of 105, and I knew I needed medical attention, but I wasn't going to disturb any doctor at that time of the night. So I just rolled on the floor and drank scotch to relieve the pain. And then in the morning I called a friend of mine and ended up in the hospital, and they gave me shots of morphine and all the tubes and things like that to go with it to relieve the pain and get that under control. All these doctors that in that town and the surrounding towns that were quite close there all knew that I was, they were friends of mine and knew I was in the hospital for this very severe attack of pancreatitis. They all know, of course, that pancreatitis is a disease that has a few rare causes to it, or else it's caused by gallbladder trouble, which I didn't have, or else it's caused by chronic alcoholism. Yet nobody came and talked to me about my drinking. At least I don't recall that they did, except for the one doctor who was going to have to operate if he made the wrong diagnosis. If it wasn't pancreatitis, he needed to operate, and if it was, he had to be careful not to. And so he made a point to come up, it seems like he made a point to come up late one evening to talk to me about whether or not I drank excessively. And when he asked me that, I was shocked, and I says, "Heavens, no. I said, I only drink a couple of nightcaps to get to sleep at night." And this is at the time that I was drinking large quantities of scotch in order to get to sleep and stay asleep. I'd gotten the scotch in order to, as a way of controlling my drinking some years before. We were going to go to a dinner dance for the church, and it seemed terribly, terribly important to me to not have anybody get the thought that maybe I drank too much. I had to hide my drinking. Through almost all the years of my drinking, I kept it hidden as much as I could. I went to various liquor stores and delicatessens and supermarkets to buy the liquor so that no one clerk would see me very often, because it seemed terribly, terribly important to not let anybody get the thought that maybe I drank too much. We were going to go to this dinner dance, I wanted to be very careful not to drink too much, I didn't know how to do it, but my wife was at that time drinking scotch and soda, which I hated. I couldn't stand scotch, and I hated soda, and so that night, that's what I chose to drink, was scotch and soda, so I could control my drinking, and it worked quite well. I believe I had only two drinks and controlled myself quite well, and got home and got drunk and went to bed. From then on, we bought scotch by the case. I bought liquor by the case. I bought that from a friend, and then I kept replenishing the case from bottles that I'd buy someplace else so it wouldn't look like I was buying too much. Trying to keep that hidden, too. The same way with after the pancreatitis, then I went on to having the convulsions, and then got to the program. After the 6 months, when my daughter spoke to me about my drinking, the first year in the program, I didn't say a word to anybody. Oh, maybe toward the end of the year, I'd speak a little bit at a small participation meeting, but usually I didn't participate at all. I'd go to the meeting at the last minute and leave just as soon as I could so that nobody would talk to me. I had the feeling that if you knew me, that you might tell me that it was true, that I hadn't drunk enough and I wasn't really an alcoholic, or that really doctors didn't become alcoholics and I didn't belong. But I think mostly it was because I didn't want you to look inside and see me. and see what I was like. For me to stand up here and tell you how I felt or I feel about anything is just the reverse of anything that's going on before AA. I have always been very reluctant to let anybody know how I felt about anything. And my program has been to try to express my feelings in that. When I first came here, all I had was the second half of the first step, saying that my life was unmanageable, because that was obvious since I was here from a mental hospital. And that helped me with the second step on the insanity part. And I had a little trouble turning I still have a great deal of trouble turning my will and my life over to God repeatedly or consistently. But I had to change my relationship with God in order to practice the third step well, because my concept of myself changed, then my concept of other people changed, and my concept of God changed, and I found it easier to have a working relationship not only with my wife and other people, but also with God. I'd had so much guilt at this all through my drinking time. The guilt was tremendous. I had divided all activities into various grades of venial sins and then mortal sins, and most all of them were on the mortal side. And once you committed one of those, that you're going to burn forever and ever and ever, plus all eternity. So that they said you shouldn't do it a second time because that was worse than the first time, but I figured one eternity wasn't two, weren't any worse than one. And so anything I did once, I figured I might as well hurry up and do again. And anything I did twice, I got addicted to. So at the end of that first year on the program, there was a Christmas meeting. And the topic was gratitude. We were to go around the room and tell what we had to be grateful for. And I was about the last one to speak. And I said that I thought that I was probably the most grateful person in the room. And some of the old-timers didn't like that right off. But with a newcomer to say that. But anyway, the reason I was grateful was that the night before, I had been up all night with a man with a heart attack. He'd called in, and I had him go directly to the hospital and got him admitted and got him into the intensive care unit, at which he had a heart attack, and then he began to develop complications. And he developed one complication after another in order. And I had to keep thinking of things to do to counteract these without doing too much or it would tip the scale too far. And it was quite an exercise through the night in doing these things to keep this man alive. The fact that he lived isn't the point. I suppose if he were telling the story, it would be the point. But the point was that I was glad to just be able to be there and be able to think and be able to perform and do the things I was supposed to do. Particularly because just exactly a year before that, I had there was a New Year's Eve party and one of the big social affairs, and I had sent my wife to it to get over her objections. Because it seemed to me that if she went, it wouldn't be so noticeable that I didn't go, and therefore people wouldn't notice that I was trying not to drink or something. I don't know what the significance was, but it was very significant to me at the time. And so she went, and while she was gone, I had a man had a heart attack, and I admitted him to the hospital. And I don't remember the situation too well. But it seemed all seemed very casual. And when she got home, she We had a couple of drinks and went to bed, is all I remember. We had a couple of drinks together because it was New Year's Eve. And that's the last I remember was, I don't remember going to bed, I just remember having a couple of drinks together. And the next thing I know that I was on the phone hanging it up, and I said, I'll be right there. And she said, what's that? And I said, the hospital just called, and this man's heart stopped, and Dr. Ward and a couple other doctors are working on him, and I've got to get right over there. And she said, you can't go in that condition. And there I was, so drunk that I couldn't get my pajama pants off in order to get dressed. I was rolling on the floor, trying to get ready, and yelling back at her that she didn't understand that I had to get over there. And finally she called back and said that I wouldn't be able to make it, which was the obvious truth, as a matter of fact. I just couldn't make it. And the fact that it was Dr. Ward who was there was significant in the sense that first off, he was the chief of staff of the hospital, and also he's the doctor that had called me 8 months before one morning. Should have known better than to call in the morning anyway, but I was with a patient when he called to say that he had had to get up about 5 o'clock in the morning to go to the hospital to sign out to declare dead a patient whom I had declared dead about 3 o'clock in the morning. And the reason was that the patient's daughter wouldn't allow her mother's body to be moved until some other doctor had seen her mother. And she said that I was drunk. And I said, I couldn't think of anything to say very quickly, especially on a morning like that when I had a bit of the flu anyhow. But I said something about I had taken some antihistamines the night before, and they always affected me funny, and maybe that's what made her say that. And he said, no, he said, she said that you looked drunk, and you talked drunk, and you walked drunk, and you smelled drunk. And so that sort of thing is what took so much of the fun out of practicing medicine that way. I had never felt that I had fit anywhere. It seemed that any time I was going to graduate from school, I went through pharmacy school and then graduate school and then medical school, and every time I was going to get a graduate diploma or a certificate for anything, or when I joined a Sertoma or any point, I kept thinking, now is when they're going to tell me. Now is when I'm going to get the secret. Now is when I'm going to know what's going to happen, how to make it from here. What is it that everybody out there seems to know that I don't know? And nobody ever gave me the pearl of wisdom until I came to AA. And that seems to be what I found here. And I found a way of life that I'm comfortable with. And I feel like I fit. I guess that's my story. May not impress you very much, but with how what I was like and what's happened and what I'm like now, but it sure impresses me. I may not have drunk as much as you did, or maybe I didn't a lot of things you didn't do, but I feel no competition. No competition in this at all. To me, I can say that I'm glad. I'm just real glad that I'm an alcoholic. I don't know. There's a lot about the past that I'm not proud of, but it's apparently what I had, the price I had to pay to get here. And I don't know but what one drink less and maybe I wouldn't have made AA. And I also don't know that one drink more, and maybe I'll never have another crack at AA. Maybe this is the only chance I'll get. So I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.